This talk was given by Bear Gokhan Bonnebacher at the Zen Center of New York City. Gokhan is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Noble One, I have set my mind on supreme perfect enlightenment, but I do not know how an enlightening being is to learn and carry out the practice of enlightening beings. I hear you give enlightening beings instruction. Please tell me how to learn and carry out the practice of enlightening beings. And this is from the last book, the last section of the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is also known as the Flower Ornament Scripture, which is a huge Mahayana text. It was the first sutra to be to come to China, and be so it was sort of it was the way that Buddhism was introduced to China from India, and so it had a really important influence on all of the Buddhism that came from sort of that trunk, which means us, and so Buddhism in China, Buddhism in Japan, Buddhism in Korea. All came through this text. And it was very influential on the Zen school. There was a whole school that grew up around this text, the Avatamsaka Sutra, at the same time that Zen was emerging. And so they influenced each other. And Zen was the school that sort of carried on, but is part of our tradition. And yet we don't study it. And so this is a text that has sort of drawn me, called to me over the years. It is huge, and I have a feeling that's why it doesn't get studied very much. And so over the years, I would pick it up, and I would say, okay, I want to know what this is about. I want to study this. And I would read for a while, and I would just get bogged down. It is vast. It is a very different style than I think we're used to in Zen. It is very... it is vast. I feel like that's like the description of it. You know, there are these, you know, the beginning that I kept coming back to and never really getting through was this immense gathering of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They've all gathered for a teaching, and they're just pages and pages of just explaining who's there. And their, you know, this Buddha's qualities and their name, and they all have these kind of amazing names and powers, and all of their retinues, the practitioners, the students, the disciples that they've brought with them, and it's like this huge congregation, so I just kept sort of getting, I never kind of got through that, but I kept kind of coming back to it, and I finally figured out that the last section, so the last 400 pages of the 1500 page book, is a summary and has often been presented as a separate text. And then I also discovered that there was a commentary, a very brief commentary to that last section, and so I was like, okay, this is possible. And I went back to it, and this winter I had some time to spend actually quite a bit of time with it, just in the course of a week or so. And I felt like I was starting to enter a little bit, starting to reveal itself a little bit to me. And so this last book, it's the Ganda Vyuha, which translates as the entry into the realm of reality. And this entry into the realm of reality is the story of Sudana, who is a bodhisattva, so an enlightening being as a bodhisattva. He has committed himself to finding enlightenment, to achieving enlightenment. And he's at a teaching that Manjushri, the bodhisattva, is a manifestation of wisdom and understanding of the absolute, of recognizes him because he asks a question. He asks this question, basically. He says, teach me. I don't know how to practice as a bodhisattva. He said, I am a bodhisattva, he's saying, right? And I need, and I don't know how to practice as a bodhisattva. Please teach me. And Manjusha gives him instruction and then sends him off on this journey. And it's a journey in which he meets 52 different teachers, many different, kind of a wide variety of teachers. Some of them are monastics. Many of them are not monastics. About half of them are women. There are children. There are perfumers. Many of them live in cities and teach in cities and kind of teach in the midst of all of this activity. Many of them live in kind of amazing palaces, and people come to their palace, and there are all these people passing through and seem to be receiving instruction both simply by observing what is kind of presented in these amazing settings and are receiving the teachings directly from these teachings. And these teachers all dedicated to rescuing people from the ocean of the mundane whirl, the ocean of the mundane whirl, and to develop them, to develop in them a taste for the way of Buddhahood. So it's a recurring theme. And so each teacher that Suddhana meets, when he arrives, he says to them a variation of this, but he says to all of them, "Noble one, I have set my mind on supreme perfect enlightenment, but I do not know how a bodhisattva is to learn and carry out the practice of bodhisattvas. I hear you give bodhisattvas instruction. Please tell me how to learn and carry out the practice of enlightening beings." And I think it's interesting that the way this bodhisattva is translated as enlightening beings is both, I don't know how to practice myself, and I don't know how to, I don't know the practice of helping other beings to enlighten, how to enlighten beings. Very much both those, both things are happening. This is for his own practice, and so that he can help others. And so Suddhana is a great example of a student. Right. He is actually quite an accomplished practitioner himself. Right, Manjushri recognizes him as something special. And yet each teacher that he approaches with this humble asking, "Please teach me. I don't know how to practice. Please teach me. Please help me." As he travels from one teacher to the next, he practices what he's been taught by that previous teacher. As he approaches one of the teachers, the sutra says that his mind is progressing rapidly and irreversibly towards omniscience. And yet he arrives at the next teacher and he says, "I don't know how to practice. Please teach me. Please help me." And each teacher gives him teaching, shares their methods. Each teacher has mastered some aspect of the Dharma, or through a particular practice has mastered the Dharma. But each teacher says that they have mastered what they have mastered. They know what they know, but they don't know everything. There are things that they know that they don't know. And so each teacher teaches him and then sends him on and says, "This is what I know, this is what I can teach you, but now go to this next teacher, because they know things, they can teach you things that I can't teach you." So each teacher also demonstrating this humility, this knowing that there is always more for us to understand, more to open up. And each of the teachers that Suddhana meets are teaching, are helping people, are that is what their activity is in different ways. They all use different ways, different means, skillful means. So one teacher, it was really there's this really kind of awful description of how he's actually scaring people into kind of living a good life, right? And that is his skillful means. And Sudhana is shocked by it until he understands what's actually happening. And the next teacher, the very next teacher that he goes to is completely the opposite, is very gentle and loving, and that is what is skillful in that place for those people. A number of them live in these amazing places, and Sudhana realizes that everyone who comes there is receiving food and drink. And the teachers say, yes, I feed them first, right? I give them, in some cases, they give them everything that they want. They give them jewels and riches. And then they teach them. Then they're ready to hear the teaching. And so one of the perfumers, right, so kind of a wizard who knows how to use scent to change, to help people experience different aspects of themselves. And so this perfumer uses scents that bring happiness and joy. And he says to Sudhana, when they become happy and joyful, then I begin to purify their minds and teach them in such a way that they become certain of supreme enlightenment. And so he sees how each teacher teaches, receives their teaching, and then goes on to the next, practicing their teaching as he goes. And one of the teachers that he meets that stood out for me was Jayosh Mayatana. And this is a priest who is practicing an ascetic practice of enduring fierce heat, all the while with his mind on enlightenment. And so all around him are huge bonfires creating this heat. And rising above appeared a great mountain precipice, a razor edge path. And Sudhana comes to him as he does to every other teacher, and he says, Noble One, I have set my mind in supreme perfect enlightenment, but I do not know how an enlightened being is to learn and carry out the practice of a bodhisattva. I hear you give enlightening beings instruction. Please teach me. Help me to learn and carry out the practice of a bodhisattva. And he says to Sudhana, our hero, he says, climb this razor edge path, climb this mountain and jump into the fire. Thus will your enlightening practice be purified. And our hero hesitates, which is natural. And he reflects on his great good fortune. And there's a traditional set of reflections on reflecting on the good fortune of being born human, of being born at a time when the Dharma is available. His good fortune of having aroused bodhicitta, the mind that seeks enlightenment. Not everyone does that. Not everyone experiences that. And that then he has encountered the Dharma, he's encountered the teachings that he so wants, is looking for. He is engaged in practice. What good fortune. He seeks to help others who seek the Dharma. This should not be taken lightly. And so he worries, what if this teacher is actually a demon? What if he's trying to thwart me, trying to stop me on my journey? Trying to harm me? And so he hesitates. He doesn't just climb up the path and jump into the fire. And the commentary says, because it is ordinarily unthinkable to contravene the objective order, Sudhana hesitates. So this grabbed me. It is ordinarily unthinkable to act contrarily to what we think of as the objective order, what we think of as reality, what we think of as what we're used to doing. It is ordinarily unthinkable to change our habits, to not act in the way that we habitually act. And we have to leap. Do something different. Not continue to respond to what we think is reality in the way that we usually respond to it. And so the question is, what is it to leap? How do we leap? Where do we leap? What does that mean? I was thinking, you know, I think that we can kind of forget how radical the Buddhist teachings are, kind of miss how radical practice itself is, what we're doing, how radical it is. And that part of my experience of the teachings, of reading something like the Avatamsaka Sutra, is that it's a reminder and an inspiration to remember that there is something radical being offered. There is this inconceivable reality, and there is a way to enter it. And so the splendor and beauty and wonder of the Avatamsaka Sutra is saying that. These millions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas under their jeweled parasols offering millions of jewels to millions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. This vast reality, that this is meant to be inspiring, and it's humbling. Right? So not to let our practice be small. And always our job in as practitioners in encountering a text, a teaching, is to look to find, how does this, what does this say for my practice? So this vast, inconceivable presentation, what does it say, mean for me? Right, that's what it's there for. And so like Sudhana, to approach a teaching and ask, how do we do that? And I think that we kind of miss this, can miss the radical, dazzling splendor, because we don't see that actually, right? It's not out there. We just sit and we face our mind in zazen. We just see a thought and let a thought go, and another thought. We see desire, see how we're caught in desire, and see how we can let that go. That in letting go, there is liberation, there is freedom. And so to translate, to see that the radical shift is in our mind, right? Where else could it be? The shift is in our lived experience. Where else could it be? And so Sudhana hesitates, he doesn't jump. It's the first teacher he's come to, he hasn't just responded. And when he hesitates, the sky sort of opens up, and all of these groups of gods come and speak to him. And so the first group is 10,000 Brahma gods who stand in the sky. And the Brahma gods think of themselves as they are creators and lords and supreme beings. But they're also, they're attached to that. They're attached to their views and their views of themselves. And they explain this to Sudhana. And that because the priest Jayoshimayatana, because of his austere practice, they have been inspired. Because of the light of the fires of his practice and seeing his practice, they no longer can take pleasure in their views of themselves, their pride in themselves. And so they went to him and asked for the teachings, and he taught them to let go of their pride, to let go of their arrogance. He teaches them, it says, so that they can use their great powers to suffuse all the world with love and compassion. He teaches them so that they can fully open themselves to the Buddha's teachings and increase their determination for enlightenment. And then there are pages of these groups of gods who stand in the sky. And each group of gods has a different a different pleasurable realm that they live in, and thus a slightly different attachment, slightly different kind of pleasure that they're attached to. And each of these groups stand in the sky and tell Sudana how this priest has inspired them by his austere practice. And then in the light of the fire, which is the light of adamantine knowledge, that there's no pleasure in what was once pleasurable for them. His practice has caused them to see how shallow their pursuit of desire has been, and to turn instead to the teachings and ask for the teachings, to ask for help. And so his example helps them to let go, helps them to take a leap. That's what they're telling Sudana. Take a leap. They have leaped free of their accustomed ways, their attachments. And they're speaking to him from having experienced some freedom. And so it's worth noting that each of these groups of gods comes to Sudana and says, because of this priest's practice, we saw the shallow nature of our pursuit of pleasure. We saw that it was not what we thought it was. And we've turned instead towards practice. They are moved to give up their godly lives. And so again, this theme that he taught them to put an end to mundane cravings, or in this case, godly cravings, and to develop craving for the pleasure of the way of enlightenment. This is a leap. This is contrary to our normal order. And this is a part of the teaching that I think we don't really want to look at, right? This very basic, fundamental part of the Buddhist teaching that we are suffering and that the cause of our suffering is our desire. And that if we can transcend this desire, there is liberation. And so we should look at this. What does this mean in our lives, in this time and place where so many of us live like gods, right, with all the pleasures available to us? And yet, knowing that in the midst of that pleasure, in the midst of this plenty, there is unhappiness, there is dissatisfaction in us. We are invested in our pursuit of pleasure. We have invested a lot in it, put a lot of energy into it. We should look at this teaching, this fundamental teaching, in our own lives. And I think some of our resistance, and I say this from my own experience, is that we have a particular, some of us, or sort of in our culture, is a particular relationship to and sort of religious teachings around pleasure and desire, that it's bad, that there's something, there's sort of the puritanical approach that it's better to suffer. Right? That is in me. And the danger of that, right, that the danger of feeling that there's something wrong with us if we pursue this. If we do, and particularly if we do something that's considered wrong, and so that we're encouraged to deny aspects of ourselves, and then this has been used to oppress. And so there's a healthy resistance to this. But that is different from the Buddhist teachings. And so this is one of, I think, a place where we have to find our way and find what is actually the teaching and what is healthy, what is liberating. And so the morality in Buddhism has much more to do with what is skillful, what is helpful, what is in harmony and what is not in harmony. What are wholesome acts that lead to wholesome results? And what are unwholesome acts that lead to unwholesome results? We can know the difference. And so the challenge is for us to take responsibility for that and know the difference, learn the difference, and act in a way that is wholesome and then helpful and skillful. Helpful for us and helpful for others. That creates good rather than harm. To know that we can choose that and that it's a choice. Right? Choose that freely. That's what's offered. And so in the Buddhist teachings, there's nothing wrong with pleasure. But it's presented as that there is danger in pleasure because it's not permanent. It's not going to satisfy us in the way that we want it to. It won't last. And because we want it to last and expect it to last, and desperately try to make it last, we suffer. And so in our search for wholeness, we turn to pleasure, and it may seem that we find some wholeness in pleasure. There is a sense of satisfaction. There are moments of completeness. But then we grab onto that and try and make it last. And that doesn't work. And so to study this in the subtlety of our mind, right? Sometimes it's really obvious, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's very subtle, right? Our minds are very subtle. And so as we settle, as our minds clear, we uncover just different levels of clinging, attachment, of seeing what we create. So to see how we will take very simple experiences, find pleasure in them, and there's something real, that's a true experience in the moment. And then later, we turn and we try to conjure that up again. We do conjure it up again in our mind because we can create pleasure. We can go back to that in our mind and there can be some pleasure there. But we should look at that, how much energy we spend recreating these experiences that are gone, that aren't here anymore. How much work goes into that. And where is the liberation? So what happens when we let go of that, when we don't do that? What's there? Right? Can we take a leap so that we can see that? And so this leap is in our actions, and it's in our mind. And it can be quite subtle. It can be not so big and flashy. It's not jumping off of a cliff into a big fire. And yet, when we take a leap, when we let go, things change. And that can be radical. So one after another, these celestial beings come forth and stand in the sky and tell Sudana mostly the same thing. This priest inspired us, helped us to take a leap, helped us to see things differently. Trust him, he is a true teacher. Follow his instruction. The commentary says, because this inconceivable realm of energy use must be entered into experientially, the spirits encouraged Sudana. This is so important. We have to enter ourselves. We have to have our own experience. And so the spirits, these celestial beings, don't want Sudana to miss this opportunity, to not see what they have seen. And this is really what all of the teachings are doing. All of the teachings, all of our teachers want for us, simply to see, to experience the same liberation that they have. They know that it's possible because they've experienced it. They see that we don't have to suffer in the way that we're suffering. And they want us to know that for ourselves so that we don't suffer. And what they're asking is for us to experience it, right? To practice in such a way that we see it for ourselves. And so finally, Sudana is convinced, and he prostrates himself at the feet of the priest. He apologizes. He says, I'm sorry that I didn't trust you. I see now that you are a true teacher. And he climbs up the mountain path and throws himself into the fire. So what is the leap that we have to take ourselves? How do we allow ourselves to be guided? He pointed to where we need to leap, which path we need to take. We see that for ourselves. Find for ourselves the path we need to take. This starts again very simply. So when we're practicing concentration, we have to do that for ourselves. We have to know for ourselves what it is to be concentrated in our mind. To completely give ourselves, give all of our awareness to our breath, to counting our breath. Right? Someone very honestly told me yesterday that when he started sitting, what kept him here was that when he sat down, he realized that if he was honest, he couldn't get to one. Right? So how honest are we? And again, that's not I don't mean that as like a moral thing. This is between you and you. Right? But to experience concentration, how that is constantly a place to deepen. It is constantly, we are constantly able to deepen that. To let go, to truly let go, what does that mean? Nobody can tell you what that means. You have to experience that. And in my experience, I'm still exploring that. Years and years of sitting. I imagine that that's continual. So we have to experience it for ourselves. As Sudana was falling, he attained an enlightened concentration called well-established. On contact with the fire, he attained an enlightening concentration called mystic knowledge of the bliss of tranquility. He said, "How wonderful is the pleasant feeling of this fire and this razor-edge mountain." And then that story is over, which I thought was interesting. So this struggle, and he does it, and he experiences great concentration and He experiences liberation, right? That's why that is blissful. And then it's over, and Jayosh Mayatana says, great, you've experienced this, this is what I can teach you, and this is what I can teach you, and go now. And he sends him to the next teacher, who is a girl named Maitrayani. Go ask her for her teaching. She can teach you about resolve and energy and determination. And so he goes, and his journey continues. So, may we be inspired by Sudhana. That's what he's there for. His student mind, his asking, his constant asking, his constant looking, his determination. His determination to find his own freedom and to find freedom to help others, to teach others. And may we be grateful for our great fortune. And may we use that for good, for ourselves and for others.
Thanks so much for listening. The monastery's quarterly journal, Mountain Record, has a new home at mountainrecord.org. For over 30 years, Mountain Record has been offering spiritual seekers of all faiths a unique journey through words and images. Each quarterly issue delivers a thought-provoking array of classic teachings, contemporary wisdom, stunning photographs, and news from the Mountains and Rivers Order. For more information, to subscribe, or to read our open access articles, visit mountainrecord.org.